Welcome to America's Top Rebbetzins. In the merit of this class, may Hashem watch over all the Jewish people and give enormous strength to the IDF soldiers, including Menachem Mendel ben Rachel, Menachem Ziv HaKohen ben Rivka Malka, Menasha ben Dikla, and Mendel Tuvia ben Devorah. Please click on the subscribe button to subscribe to us on the America's Top Rebbetzins YouTube page, or click follow to follow us on your podcasting app so that you are the first to know when an inspiring new episode is posted. Today, I am so happy to welcome Devorah Nussbaum. Devorah is a psychotherapist. She is a trauma therapist who has a multidisciplinary approach addressing mind, body, and breath. And some of the modalities that she has trained in include IFS, body psychotherapy, EMDR, comprehensive resource model, logotherapy, and also the Imago model of relationship therapy. She has experience working with victims of abuse, eating disorders, relationships, relational trauma, religious trauma, and also addiction. Devorah uses her knowledge of human psychology and relationships to help people face their fears and break free from all they feel is holding them back from living an inspired and meaningful life. She also has a fantastic podcast called Hasidus Through the Eyes of a Psychotherapist. Wow. You have done so much and accomplished so much. I'm so happy to have you here with us. Please tell us more about yourself and what you do.
Oh, wow. It's so interesting for me listening to you read that to me. I'm like, oh, wow. I did all that. I really love what I do. I think you've kind of summarized it very well, but I really just love working with women and in couples and helping people to just really become the best versions of themselves. And I think when I say best, I don't mean like, you know, better, worst. I kind of mean just the most authentic, fully expressed, the part of us that we all want to be, that we're all looking to become, just to shine our lights. And it's really beautiful to see. And I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I really, really do love that. I, you know, we're going to be talking about something, some really deep things today. So I think all this will come out with your modalities of healing and the way that you love helping people and women step into their authentic selves, because that's really what we're here to do. Like in life, we're here to step into our authentic selves and be the person who we really actually meant to be. So, yes. So let's dive in. I mean, the reason that I'm so happy to be speaking with you today is that you have the knowledge and also the experience to teach us powerful tools that will help us heal psychologically and spiritually. So before the show, you mentioned that there is actually an intersection between psychology and spirituality. However, in our culture, we like to separate the two. We need to recognize that their spirituality and psychology are really one and the same. So I would really like to start out by exploring that concept. So can you please explain to us in detail about what psychology is and also what spirituality is and how the two are really one?
Okay, it's a great question. So I want to start by defining what I mean when I say spirituality. So there is basically how I describe it is anything that you cannot touch, anything that is not physical is spiritual. So for example, a thought. You cannot touch a thought. You cannot touch an emotion. I mean, you can see the effect of a thought on the physical body. So if I was thinking from a certain part of my brain on a brain scan, you would see it light up. But that is not a thought that I'm seeing. It's the effect of the thought on my brain. And the same thing with an emotion. I could feel fear, and the result of my feeling fear can create a nervous system reaction. My heart rate can speed up. My breath can become short and shallow. That might be the result of me feeling the fearful emotion. But I can't see fear or touch fear with my physical container or my physical body. Right. Therefore, it is spiritual. Okay, this is how I define spiritual. Of course, there are many ways of defining spiritual, and there are many levels to spirituality. But the very basic definition that I use is this: if you can't touch it, it's an idea is spiritual. The capacity to grow, for example, the life force energy inside of our body that makes us run. This is all on the level of what Hasidus calls soul. The life force energy within us that moves our bodies, but you can't necessarily grasp it, touch it. The closest you can get to it is to feel the warmth of your body and to feel the effect of that life force energy. You feel your pulse, you can feel your breath, you can feel the effect of it, but to actually touch it itself, it's not tangible. So having said that, What is psychology? It's dealing with our emotions and our thoughts, our inner world. So really, it's pretty much the same thing, right? Our psychology, our minds and our heart, our emotions and our mental space is spiritual. And in fact, according to Chassidus, the soul is made up of 10 powers. Seven of them are ways of thinking, and three of them are ways of thinking, and seven of them are ways of feeling. And these are the powers that create our internal world. They create who we are, our personalities, and so on. Now, there are two souls that exist within each person, and each soul has five levels. Three levels are embodied, and within those three levels, there are subcategories and so on. So just like we have a complex physical anatomy, we also have a complex spiritual anatomy. And our spiritual anatomy is made up of what we, like I said, two souls. So one of them is the animal soul consciousness. The animal soul consciousness is our survival instinct. It's our natural innate traits. It's our natural personality. It's the way that we instinctively are driven to protect ourselves and keep ourselves comfortable and safe in the world. And I think a lot of the psychological field and psychological work happens on animal soul consciousness. A lot of the work that we do in a therapy room is looking at and making sense of and understanding animal soul consciousness, and also learning how to make space for our animal soul consciousness and yet not let it drive our car, not let it be the thing that drives our lives. Am I acting in my life from a place of impulse and the need for survival, the need for validation and the need for approval, which is survival for my animal soul consciousness? Or am I living my life based on a value system, based on what I know is important to me, based on living an authentic life? And this is the interface. This is where it now becomes a at this point, this is where I feel that psychology and spirituality, in the sense of how a lot of times we use spirituality, is when we talk about learning Torah, learning Chassidus, this is now where we say, so what is the value system I'm going to live my life by? This is where you bring in the teachings of the Torah, and that then feeds the divine soul consciousness. It feeds the part of us that wants to live for higher purpose. And when you combine those two together, when you combine the animal and the divine soul consciousness, that is the entire purpose of existence, is to bring them together so that they're working, animal souls working for the divine soul, they're working together in sync with each other rather than in like conflict. I feel a connection. I want to connect to Hashem, and I also want to protect myself, and I want to make sure people like me. So usually when those things are in conflict, I know this is what I want to do, this is what God wants from me, but this and this person will disapprove of me. So how do I manage that, right? We go through these experiences all the time. So this is the place when we become aware of how to harness our animal soul energy, how to direct it towards what it is that we want to live, the value system that we want to live our lives by, then we are integrating all of it.
I love that. And now I really see, now that you really fully explained it. Thank you for explaining it so beautifully. Like, really, the integration between the psychology and the spirituality, and really how they're all one. Neither one of them are tangible. I mean, thoughts, emotions, feelings, that's just so intangible. You can't touch it. And the psychology is really dealing with those things that the thoughts, the feelings, the emotions, And I think, it's so interesting because you're right. When people are going off animal consciousness over the animal soul, and then their godly soul comes and says, "Well, wait a minute, what about this? This is what your value is. You have a certain value system, but yet your animal soul is kind of saying, well, I don't feel like doing that right now." And they are sometimes in conflict. That's where we fragment a little bit, and that's where a lot of problems come into play, both problems within ourselves and also relationship problems.
Right, that's when all our defenders basically hijack us. So there's guilt, shame, judgment, criticism, blame, withdrawal, avoidance, or similar aspects of the same thing. They all hijack us when we don't have the capacity to just experience whatever we're experiencing and to maneuver the situation and to know what to do with it, right? So we protect ourselves from uncomfortable feelings.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's for sure. It's for sure. And we're gonna, you know, it's, I mean, it's so fascinating to understand how the psychology is so often associated with the thoughts and behavior is so closely linked to spirituality, as I was saying, because we often think of spirituality so rooted in faith and mindfulness. But I want to get practical for a minute. You know, when a person is in imbalance in a psycho-spiritual realm, you know, if they have a real imbalance, how does it manifest itself? What does it look like?
So when you say an imbalance in the psycho-spiritual realm, what are you referring to?
You know, like almost like what we were talking a little bit about before, you know, when the animal soul really wants to take over the godly soul, you know what I mean? When we start to fragment a little bit and we start to like not live in alignment with our soul, not living the way that we believe, but living more on instinct, more toward our animal soul.
So the way I see it is that we all start out. You know, when we're taught that when a baby is born, they're touched on the lip and they forget everything. So we are all really, truly expansive and infinite divine beings. And we've gone through a process of absolutely forgetting who we are,
Right.
completely forgetting who we are. We get born into a consciousness where all we see or is the superficial of something, and then we assume that's what it is. To start out as a baby, for example, if you don't see your mother, you think she doesn't exist. The consciousness of a baby, right? So you know, you see this with children, very, very young children. You're playing, you give them a toy and they hold it, or they're able to hold it. And then you take the toy and you put it behind your back. They're very young age. They won't look behind your back to find the toy. They actually believe that now they can't see the toy, it has disappeared. But at some point, you see the child will start figuring out that it might still exist and they'll look behind your back for the toy, right? So this is already us developing our capacity to see that just because we don't see it, it doesn't mean it's not there.
Right.
And we slowly, that slowly evolves as we go through our lives, starting out with the physical. And then also children, for example, don't know that their parents might have their own emotions and inner world. They think that they are the center of the universe. They assume that if they feel a certain way, everyone must feel that way, right? Because they don't realize that there might be another perspective.
So
And the
true.
slow process of development is where we start to see and see many perspectives and to see that there's so much deeper than what the skin is showing us. And there may be so much more to the story than I understand. And the constant willingness or desire to learn more, to see more, to grow more, and so on. And so, because we don't know and we don't see anything, what we do instinctively as very, very young children is, first of all, the unknown is the most terrifying thing for us, the not knowing who I am. And so I create stories. I start to make assumptions about reality. You know, if somebody says that, you know, I ask someone, do you want to play with me? And they say no. I assume that means that must be something wrong with me, because somehow that gives me the illusion of control over the situation. And I don't know how to deal with this, I don't have control situation when we're little. And we slowly create all of these stories in our consciousness. And as we develop and as we mature, there's always a part of us that's yearning for something more, something greater, to look deeper than the skin, to connect on a deeper level. And the animal soul consciousness development, this process of creating the stories, it's a shell, which means that it's actually protecting us from a sense of I don't know who I am at the center, and fear of feeling completely lost and alone. And so I create a story about what makes me good, what makes me right, what makes me acceptable in the eyes of others, what's going to get me validation, what's going to keep me safe. And this is kind of like what drives most of my actions in the world. And then I start seeing that there's holes in this system. Let's say I had a belief that if you do this and this and this, then you'll get validation. But I did this, this, and this, and now all of a sudden, this person didn't give me validation. So then what am I going to do with that? What am I going to do with that? If I either have to learn how to sit with the pain of disappointment or sit with the pain of loss, which is a part of the reality of life, and everyone has to learn how to do that. Otherwise, we become driven by the avoidance of pain. If I don't have the capacity to sit with my pain, I will always do the thing that I think will make me feel the least pain, because I'm just so afraid of feeling pain.
Yes.
So A lot of the work, the psychology work, is about, first of all, understanding the stories that we've created, understanding that we created them out of defense, out of protection, not because there's anything wrong with us, but we were just trying to survive. We were just literally trying to survive in a world where we completely forgot who we are. And because out of that pain and out of that not knowing how to sit with our pain, we developed a way that was going to, we thought was going to work for us. And now it's starting to crumble. Now those we're getting holes in the system. We're starting to see that the things that were protecting us actually become prisons in our lives. The walls we create to keep ourselves safe, they end up becoming the things that limit us and get in the way of us actually doing things that we want to do. And at this point, this is usually the point where people show up in therapy, where they say, "I don't know how to live anymore." There's almost like it feels like a breakdown, but really it's a break open. Really, it's now these walls are beginning to crumble. So this is a great opportunity to step into your authentic self. And this process is not necessarily so easy or straightforward, because I have to start facing the pain that created the belief system in the first place, or created the defense in the first place. If I, for example, created a belief system that I'm unlovable, it was because I was rejected. It was because I experienced rejection, and I never want to experience rejection again. So if I assume I'm unlovable, I will not put myself in a position where I'm vulnerable to them being rejected. I'll just assume nobody loves me, and I'll stay away from people and I'll avoid people. But then the consequence of that is a huge amount of loneliness. And so maybe I manage my loneliness with an addiction, which, and then it's like one thing managing another thing. Symptoms are managing each other. In order to unravel that complicated, like protection that I've created, I have to be able to sit with that feeling of rejection. I have to be able and have a lot of compassion on it and say, "Wow, that small child inside of me felt all of those big emotions and didn't know what to do with them. My goodness me." And I have to learn how to process those feelings through my body without the narrative. What that means is to be able to feel the experience of rejection or sadness or loneliness without it being because I am something. Just, "Oh, this is what loneliness feels like. This is what rejection feels like." And almost allow it to wash over you like a shower, to learn how to breathe through it, to move through it, somatically experiencing it through your body and being able to contain it and feel also your strong spine and also your feet on the floor, and to know this is the experience and I can hold it. And it also doesn't have to crush me or crumble me. In fact, I can rise into it. And it can allow me and soften me into compassion for myself and for others who feel these intense emotions and so on. And this is the process of integration. This is the process of growth. And and the more I'm able to do that, the more I'm able to then live my life, like we said, from my value system rather than from my fear-based defenses. And this is where I can now say, "Who am I really? And who is God really? And what am I even doing in this world? And what even is life force energy?" And we can start actually contemplating that there is something so much greater that exists that we're a part of, and we can see a perspective so much bigger. You know, when we're in a state of protecting ourselves, we're blinkered. We have very, very small vision. All we can see is what we need in order to survive. And then once we feel safe inside of our bodies, and we can feel safe with feeling our feelings, we can look around and say, "Wow, what have I not noticed?" You know, a lot of times when we go through this process, you start noticing the sun shining on your face, or those flowers that are growing. When we're stressed, we don't notice these things. We don't notice that there's a God and there's a world and there's purpose and there's opportunity and there's growth and there's so much that we can grow into and develop into. And this is the springboard. This is our springboard for developing in an infinite way on a spiritual level, like the way we define it, you know, growing in that way. But without a healthy psychological state, without integration of my mind, my body, and my breath, then a lot of spirituality, or a lot of times people use spirituality as almost like a defense mechanism. It's another way of getting away from themselves rather than going deeper into themselves. It becomes sometimes a form of disassociation. And if you want to know, how is my spirituality a form of disassociation, or is it genuine? I would say, how open are you? How curious are you with hearing other perspectives and learning new things? How defensive are you around your religion? And if it's def if there's defense, there is power struggle, there's control, then it's coming from a sympathetic nervous system state. It's coming from a place of protecting yourself. It's not authentic spiritual growth.
Wow. That is so beautiful and so deep. I really think that you hit the nail on the head with it. And what I found so interesting is, you know, a lot of times, like you said, we try to numb our pain, right? Who wants to feel pain? Nobody wants to feel pain. We try to numb it. But then we can never get a full sense of healing. We can never fully heal ourselves until we feel that pain and until we feel that pain fully, which is very, very hard to do because some people have gone through like some serious traumas, you know, like really, really serious things, which has left them psychologically scarred in so many different ways and feeling so many feelings. Sometimes it's not just fear, but it's betrayal, it's fear as well, it's feeling not good enough, a whole bunch of things, deep, profound sadness, depression. I mean, people are feeling so many things depending on the type of trauma or the type of life situation or circumstances that they've been through. And I feel like in our society today, we run away from this because, like I said earlier, who wants to feel pain? I don't want to feel pain. I don't know anybody who wants to feel pain, but also I can see it. I can see it like in the world around me. Like we're trying to defend ourselves and we're so busy trying to defend ourselves and protect ourselves so that we don't get hurt, that we never live fully and never step into our full authentic selves. Like as human beings, you know, we all have so much potential, like all of us, each and every one of us. But if we're stuck in that fight or flight, that defensiveness, that fear, we never get to fully experience who we are. And we live our lives as a shadow of who we really genuinely already are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's two layers to pain. There's the authentic pain, let's say that feeling of loss, or that feeling of disappointment, or that feeling of loneliness. And then there's the defenses that we build to avoid those feelings. And those defenses exacerbate the pain to such a degree that then we have to build new defenses to protect ourselves from those and new defenses to protect ourselves from those. So, for example, if I'm feeling a sense of loss, a deep sense of loss, I've just experienced my first rejection. I'm 2 or 3 years old, like the example I gave before. I wanted to play with my friend. She said no. And I don't have the capacity to think, well, maybe she just had a hard, she's having a hard day. Maybe she doesn't feel well. Maybe she's just seen that bright, colorful toy across the room, and all she can think about is, what is that? She didn't even notice I came over and asked her. I mean, there's a million reasons why kids do the things that they do, right? But I just think, oh, that means I'm really bad. You know, I go to that place. Now, I go to that place of, that means I'm really bad because I'm now feeling the sense of loss. I wanted something and I don't have it. And I don't know what to do with it. I don't know how to just breathe and say, that's what loss feels like. Wow. Yeah, I feel it moving through my body, across my chest, down my arms. Oh, yes, that's loss. Wow, interesting. That's an intense experience. Yeah, I just had that. Wow. We don't do that as 2-year-olds. We
No.
just go to, like, oh, no, that means I'm bad. The shame now. The shame is now a protection from the loss. And then I don't know what to do with shame. So I protect it with anger now. Like, so now I'm angry with her. She comes to ask me if she wants to play with me tomorrow. I'm gonna say no. And that gives me a sense of like power. And that feels a little more comfortable than the shame, and a little more comfortable than the loss. And then and so on. And we build these layers and we build these defenses. And I would say that so much of people's pain is because of the layers of defense that they have built to protect themselves from the pain. And actually, when we become present with the essence of the pain, and we have the capacity and we need help, we need people to guide us through this process because it's confusing, like, to know what is a defender, what's my authentic emotion, and to have the capacity or to feel safe enough to just relax into the experience of intensity of that experience, and allow, and we have to feel safe enough to do that. So doing it together with someone who's trained in understanding how this works is very, very helpful. But once we get to understand the layers of what's my defensive layers, what's my authentic pain, dealing with my defenses the way that I deal with defenses, dealing with my authentic pain in the way I deal with authentic pain, creating mental clarity. Creating mental clarity, it means really, even if the stories in the background are still playing because they're just a habit of playing, but to actually know who I am and to know that I'm not these stories. Once I have all of that, then I can move through the painful experiences with so much more ease. And almost, it can almost be exhilarating to an extent because it means I'm alive. So I can process my grief and I can also experience joy and I can lean from one and move to the other like a flame, just like flickering through life. And I can be fully alive with whichever experience is flushing through me right now. without feeling like I need to protect myself from it. And this is how you can live with an open heart. This is how you're able to live with presence, with compassion, and so on, and all of these traits, which are in authentic alignment with, with the ultimately what we came here to do, to be our true authentic selves. So yeah, so I would say that we're afraid of feeling feelings, and often it's because we just don't actually know how to do it, and we don't have the support to do it, and we also don't know the difference between a defender and a feeling. And the more confusion we have, the more afraid we are of it, because the unknown is very scary.
Yeah, yes, it's exactly. The unknown is very scary. And I feel so bad because there's so many people struggling today with so many different things, like really, really struggling, having their defense mechanisms up. And my goal today was really also for to try to understand what they're going through, as you've explained. And also I want to see if maybe we can give our listeners some practical tools that they can start using today, start implementing in their lives today in order to help them on their healing journey. I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about things that people can do on their own today. And also I know that you were saying like it is really important to work with somebody who really can help you unravel the confusion a little bit. So maybe we can talk about approaching this type of healing both in both ways, both with a professional and on our own.
Yeah. So one of the really important things, skills that we need to learn how to do this work is to become able to observe ourselves with curiosity, and to really watch, first of all, what's happening in our physical bodies. And when I say watch what's happening in our physical bodies, when I say watch, I mean pay attention to things like muscle tension, the way that when you feel a certain emotion, it feels in your body. So for different people, that will be different. And even in the English language, we use things like butterflies in your stomach, or a knot in, or a lump in your throat, or a knot in your, I don't know, in your gut, or whatever. We describe emotions as having physical experiences of tension in our body. So noticing where you feel the tension, and especially the muscle tension around it, in it, around it, and then even further around it. So doing, noticing. Noticing the more and more bigger circles around it. The most important thing is to develop a voice that is able to observe it without making a story about it. So sometimes we are able to observe ourselves, but then we create a narrative about, oh, that means dot dot dot, or oh, because I have that, that means, or what's wrong with me? Why do I always feel that way? So when you notice that those narratives are coming, observe them also in your body, and where they come from. If they coming from a part of your head, are they coming from, do they feel bigger than your body? Do they feel in your body or out of your body? And I think the most helpful way of observing, just to be able to observe ourselves, is to almost draw a circle around the experience that we're having, to find the edges of it. I was working with someone the other day, for example, who was experiencing a lot of pain. So this was the process. It was, okay, how big is the pain? Is it bigger than your body? Yes. Is it bigger than your house? Yes. Is it bigger than, the town that she lives in? Yes. Is it bigger than the city that you live in? No. And then she described there's a motorway, like a freeway around the edge. And she said, it's just in the line of that.
Okay.
And it was interesting, because when she was able to see, okay, that's what it was, she almost just like stepped back and observed, and she said, wow, that is a lot of pain I'm carrying. And in that moment, there was a sense of relief of, I can see and can take, okay, this is what it is. There's something about observing it fully, all of it, that is so containing, to be able to say, this is what it is. And the way I see it is a little bit like, imagine we're in our consciousness, we're all like a Russian doll set. You know those Russian dolls, we have the tiny in the middle and the bigger and the bigger and the bigger versions of ourselves, right? So our consciousness is a bit like that. And when we're in child consciousness, we might be that tiny little like person in the middle. Now, if you take that tiny little person in the middle, and you put her, let's say, in a bucket of water, she's just gonna fall down, like she's gonna drown in it. She can't even see her way out of it. But if you have the biggest version of the Russian doll, which let's say maybe is the size of my body or even bigger than my body, I'm just looking down at a cup of water with a small version of myself drowning in. And there's something that now, because I can perceive it from an external place, there's a containment in it. It's like, oh, there's a part of me that feels like it's drowning. And it's not all of me, because I have higher levels of consciousness that are observing this part. And the more that we're able to shift we don't get to constantly be in one state of consciousness or another. But if I learn how to shift from being that drowning person to being that observing myself drown, the more I'm able to kind of travel in my consciousness and contain parts of myself and therefore feel less overwhelmed by them. You know, the size of the pain isn't going to change, but if my consciousness expands in size, I can contain it better. Another way of understanding is a little bit like a table. You know, take a big table and put it in the middle of a tiny room. And if I'm, it takes up all the space, that's all there is. But I take the exact same table and put it in a massive hall, it's still the same table. The pain is still the same pain. The challenge is still the same challenge, but I have more space to observe it. I have more space to work with it. I'm less overwhelmed by it. I may also notice there's so many other things as well that I can bring and use to hold this experience and grow through it. And so expanding my consciousness is a very, very important part of my healing journey. And the way I do it is to watch myself and then to watch myself watching myself and to watch all the different parts of myself and how they interact with each other. And to even stand back from myself and observe, especially when I feel completely overwhelmed, to just observe the big mountain of insane, like kicking and punching and screaming and crying happening just at, wow, and that's all happening inside of me. Oh my goodness. Wow, look at that. I've been carrying that all this time. Gosh, that's a lot. Like to just be able to observe it with that kind of compassion and curiosity, just without a judgment on it. Just, oh, interesting. That's what it is. That is something that everyone can learn to do. And it is always a first port of call when I'm, you know, people say, give me something to do. This is what I would say. If you can learn how to observe yourself, you will start seeing that there is the capacity to almost contain, even if it's massive, even if it's huge. There's the edges of it as well. And when you see the edges of it, there's also something else beyond it.
Right.
You know? So in my body, for example, if I'm feeling grief in my chest and I notice that it takes up all the space up to my neck and down to my solar plexus and all the way to my shoulders, I can also notice after a while of observing that actually my legs or my feet feel pretty calm and relaxed, and so do my hands. And I can almost use my hands and my feet as a container, like a loving, soft mother, to just hold the part of me that's tantruming. So now I have both parts. I'm aware of the calm part of me and the pained part of me, and I can use one to hold the other. And this is very soothing. This is very regulating, and this is very grounding. So instead of me becoming, another way of looking at this is a bit like being in a storm. You know, imagine like a storm. You're either in the eye of the storm, observing the storm, or you're in the storm being thrown about like by the wind.
Yes.
And there's no diff there's such a huge difference in feeling like you're in the storm, observing the, sorry, you're in the eye of the storm, you're in that calm, still place, and you're observing it with like, wow, that's a big storm happening, to actually being thrown around in this chaos. And so finding the capacity to just hold and observe is really the most important starting point. And learning also how to breathe is just as important. Observation and breathing. And probably the most, when we inhale, we stimulate our sympathetic nervous system state. And when we exhale, we stimulate our parasympathetic nervous system state, which is your safe mode, when our body feels that we're safe. And whenever we're in a stressed state, we automatically breathe in more than we breathe out. And whenever we're feeling really relaxed, we breathe out more than we breathe in. And so choosing to exhale for long periods of time, as if like humming is a great way to do that, because when you're humming, you're automatically exhaling very, very slowly for longer periods of time, or singing, for example, or blowing through a straw or whistling, and just trying to lengthen the exhale to be slow and steady and as long as you can. And especially if you're in a stress state, you're going to find that hard to do in the beginning, but just keep practicing. And it's just literally a practice. It's like physiotherapy for your nervous system. The more you do that, the more it starts to relax. And then when your nervous system relaxes, you all of a sudden have access to a part of your brain you did not have access to before, which is your prefrontal cortex. Once your prefrontal cortex comes online, all of a sudden you see the pain from a whole different perspective of, oh, I'm in pain, rather than I'm in danger. You know, there's a massive difference between I'm in danger or I'm in pain, and pain is painful, but not dangerous. You
That's a
know,
good
and I.
distinction. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's huge, because a lot of times we associate pain with danger, and therefore we can't process the pain because we're so afraid of it, because we think it means something, you know, something is we're threatened on some level. But so much of our pain, sometimes pain means danger. Yes, it's true. But so much of our pain, especially emotional pain, is not actually dangerous. It's just a difficult situation. It's an intense situation. It's a fork in the road, an opportunity for us to grow, and to make choices and to try our strengths, to find ourselves, to let go of a layer of who we thought we were and step into more authentically who we truly are. It's an opportunity, and it's not comfortable. It's not comfortable, but it doesn't mean that it's bad. It doesn't mean that it's bad, or dangerous. But
Wow.
if we don't know that, then we assume it does, and we just react accordingly. So,
Right, no, and that makes a lot of sense, right? Because when we feel pain, we think, oh my gosh, maybe more pain is coming. But we associate that with like more doom, more pain, more fear, you know? But that's not necessarily true that it's dangerous. It's just pain, which is uncomfortable. And I want to acknowledge that's uncomfortable.
super uncomfortable. But
Yes.
when we breathe and we move through our pain and we
Yes.
observe, it's more tolerable. So this is very similar to childbirth. Right? Childbirth can be extremely, extremely painful.
Yes.
But there are certain techniques and tools that you can use to move through the contractions, to breathe through the contractions, to relax your nervous system through the contractions that can make it, yes, intense. Yes, intense. And you're going to need to focus only on this for now. And you're going to need a lot of support and kindness towards yourself. And though it can still be manageable, not only that, but exhilarating. Right? And there's a difference between that and a childbirth where I feel terrified of what's happening and I go into a panic state. And then as my sympathetic nervous system is triggered, so the muscles that are trying to, the part of my body is trying to open and part of it's trying to close at the same time because the sympathetic nervous system is the clenching response. So my body's trying to open to give birth, my other parts of my body trying to close, and it can create much longer, more intense experiences of like just dragging out the experience of it. Either way, the baby's going to come, but we need to learn the tools on how to manage and travel through our pain in order for us to know that yes, we are in going to in through labor right now, and that we need to put everything else aside in our lives and focus and realize that this is a there's a time now I need to process this intensity, not to expect yourself to just continue cooking supper and whatever it is that if you were in labor, you would stop what you were doing and you would focus on. Right. But so often we think we don't have time for our pain. We need to soothe our pain, take another pill, but what happens is that they're just cooking under the surface and cooking under the surface. And we then need to distract ourselves with stronger and stronger distractions. And we feel more and more desperate as we go along. But giving ourselves the time to stop, be present and to process and to connect with ourselves and allow ourselves to move and to cry and to breathe and to dance and to express through our bodies and allow those muscles to shift and move, really is so liberating. And the way I describe it often to clients is the difference between, if you didn't know how to turn a tap off, it would be dangerous to turn a tap on in your house because you're going to end up flooding the house. So if someone turns a tap on, you go into panic, like, oh no, what are we going to do? But if you know how to turn the tap off, then it's actually very useful to turn the tap on sometimes and when you need it, right? And turning the tap off is the skill on how to learn to regulate the nervous system, how to breathe through experiences in the body, how to move through the experiences of intensity and constriction and expansion as it moves through your body, how to observe it without judgment on it, just watching what's happening. This is all what allows you to kind of turn your sympathetic nervous system off so that you can become present and connected and be guided by your value system as to what you want to do next, rather than what you're going to do because you're afraid of doing something different. Because you're afraid if you do something different, someone's going to be annoyed with you, and you're afraid of, we don't know what to do if someone's annoyed with you, and you're afraid of this and you're afraid of that, and you're just living from a place of, I'm just trying to survive and I'm just so scared. If we don't know how to bring ourselves into a space of regulating ourselves so that we're not feeling fear anymore, then we will be driven by trying to avoid pain because it is so painful. Like it
Yeah.
genuinely is so painful.
Yeah.
So it's like we just need to learn the skills. We just need to know how to do it, and then it's doable, more doable.
Right. And I love that. I really appreciate that you gave us some skills that we could do at home. We could do, but I love that you said that we need to take time to do it because you gave us the skills to do, but you also emphasized that we need to take the time to do it. We need to stop whatever it is that we're doing. Listen, there's sometimes you really, really can't stop. You're not going to stop in the middle of the road, on a highway. Like you really have to like make time, like carve out time to really, really stop. And I want to make an interesting point because I was actually listening to one of your previous podcasts earlier this morning. I was up very very early before the sun came up this morning, and I was driving and I was listening to one of your podcasts, and you said exactly this. You were telling a story about a woodcutter in a forest, and he was chopping. He was using his axe to chop down a tree, and somebody was watching him chop down the tree, and he was chopping this tree for 5 hours. And the guy who was watching the woodcutter said, "I've been watching you chop down this tree for 5 hours. Maybe if you sharpen your knife, it'll go a little bit faster, And if you sharpen your axe, it'll go a little bit faster." And the woodcutter said, "You know what? I've been chopping this tree for 5 hours. I'm halfway done. I have another 5 hours to go. I don't have time to sharpen my axe." And it was so funny. You were saying like if you just take the time to sharpen your axe, it will go faster. You have more work to do, yes, but if you sharpen your axe, it will go faster.
Right, exactly. Really understanding this is so powerful. This so often we say we don't have time to do the work, and the consequences of not doing the work end up taking us so much more time. And
Exactly.
this awareness is really powerful. Yeah.
Yes. This is what we can do ourselves. And I know I remember when I first asked the question, I also wanted to refer back to like if you're working with a therapist or working with a life coach. And I know that you're trained in so many different modalities. Like when somebody's working with you could really take it up a notch. You could really take it up a different level and maybe use some different techniques. And I was just wondering if maybe you could talk just a little bit about, if a person is really, really struggling with their pain and they're doing the things that they need to do at home, but they want that extra level of support of working with somebody. What are the types of modalities that you use to maybe help somebody work through their pain?
So what I've come to discover, I studied a lot of different modalities, and I started out just being an integrative therapist where I was just basically a talk therapist, but like using a lot of different modalities. And I came to understand the importance of working with the body so much, really through my own experience. And what I came to understand is that if we don't understand our nervous systems, very often what can happen in talk therapy is that people can talk in talk therapy from a defended place for their whole lives. 25 years you can be in talk therapy, but what hijacks your sessions is the defenders inside of you that are logical, intellectual thinkers, and so forth. And therefore, you will never actually feel that you're resolving any of the issues, because there's just basically the part of you that needs validation for the experiences that you're having is it's like almost like a plaster. It's a self-soothing experience. I'm coming here, you're validating me, I'm expressing my perspective, and I'm not actually getting to the bottom of what's going on in my nervous system. Why am I feeling so unsafe? What am I afraid to feel? What's really happening under the surface? And so I only learned about the nervous system almost by chance, because I was working with people who were very highly traumatized, and regular talk therapy wasn't working for them. Like they would like disassociate in sessions where I would say something, ask them a question, and then they wouldn't hear what I said, or they wouldn't be able to communicate. And I was like, what on earth am I supposed to do with this? And so I was researching, how do you work with this? I didn't even know what it was. And I'm so grateful that I came across understanding the nervous system, the body, how to work with it, how things are encoded inside of it, how to know what nervous system state somebody's in to help them to learn how to shift from one nervous system state to the other, and how really you can only process painful experiences when you're in a parasympathetic state. So if somebody shows up, or if we're showing up in a sympathetic nervous system state, trying to process pain in a sympathetic nervous system state isn't going to get you anywhere. You first need to regulate the nervous system. You first need to calm down the parts that feel so afraid. Then you can talk about it. Then you can talk about it and see other perspectives on it and analyze what the belief system was and where it came from and so on. And so often what happens is that when we're not aware of this, we can get stuck, like I said, in sympathetic nervous system states, or dorsal states. We can live in them our whole lives. Literally, we can spend our whole lives living in a state of defense and not even know it. And So really, I think that when if people ask me like what kind of therapist should I work with, I like to explain people about the nervous system and to say you want to work with a therapist who understands the nervous system, who understands the body and breath and mind connection. It's not just about talk therapy, but it's also not just about somatics, because what happens when we only work with the body, if our minds are not clear, if we don't gain mental clarity, then what happens is that we can calm down, we can spend a whole hour doing yoga and breathing, calm down our bodies, but then I have a certain thought or judgment on myself or belief system that then hijacks me and I go straight back into sympathetic nervous system state. So I have to address all three levels of my being simultaneously, or at least one and then the other. I have to be able to address them in order to find absolute alignment within myself. I have to have a clear mind, I have to have slow breath, and I have to have a relaxed body. And that doesn't mean it has to be fully. I don't have to have a fully clear mind or a fully relaxed breath or a fully relaxed body, because it's almost impossible for anyone to have, especially to live in a state like that all of the time. I mean, unless someone's in the level of living like a tzaddik, which according to Tanya, the level of a tzaddik is someone who's already transformed their animal soul consciousness, so they're not feeling afraid of anything, right? They are living fully in alignment with Hashem. So really what it means is just to become aware of, to have a part of my consciousness that is able to watch the thoughts in my head that are judgmental or critical and to say, wow, they're really scared. To be able to breathe and notice the tensions in my body and notice the parts that are tense and the parts that are not. So that there's this, the observer part of me, the higher consciousness is able to hold the child consciousness inside of me. And then it doesn't matter what the child's doing. The child could be kicking and screaming, but there's a certain safety in that, knowing that it's okay. We're gonna make time for you and hear what you have to say. And also, I'm the parent who's driving the car. You're in the car seat. It's okay. You're safe. You're not driving the car, because that would be really dangerous. That's the difference. And what's so interesting and I find so fascinating is this concept in Torah that we, first of all, don't be cruel to animals. This is a mitzvah that we have, and it's really important for us to use that towards ourselves. It's really important for us not to be cruel to our animal soul consciousnesses, because they are working so hard to keep us alive and surviving, and they've
Safe.
done so much for us and safe. And we need to really, really show them a lot of gratitude. And also, there's another mitzvah that says you have to feed your animals before you feed yourself, which
Yes.
is also amazing. And what is the food of the animal soul consciousness? It's compassion and validation. It's like, yes, I can see you working hard. I can see that you really care. I can see how scared you are. We have to really give them enough nourishment. I see you. And then they relax a little bit and we start to feel regulated. Then we can think about, so what do I want to do now? Where do I want to go with this? How do I want to show up to this? How do I want to grow through this? We can ask ourselves those kind of questions, but we have to work with our animals. And they become our best friends. It's like, you have a wild horse and you train it. It can be amazing when you see people who train their horses to work in sync with them in such a beautiful way that they can even like move their head and their horse changes direction, right?
Right.
But if you're afraid of your horse and you tie it up and leave it in the shed, good luck to you.
Right.
You're going to spend your whole life just trying to keep yourself safe from that horse,
Right.
The conflict is huge, but we have, it's a process of training. There is a process of training. It's like with anything, it's a practice. It's not something that we can just get. And I think a lot of the pain that we go through in childhood is where we expected to just get stuff. Like, why didn't you just clean your room? And why can't you figure out how to do that math question? And what's wrong with you that takes you so long to dot, dot, dot. And like, everyone has their different strengths and weaknesses, but we have this expectation that we're supposed to know how to do stuff without people actually holding our hand and showing us how to do it one step at a time. Why aren't you concentrating? How often do we sit and teach children how to concentrate? That there is a process of mental training to be able to expand your capacity to concentrate for longer periods of time. That is not an automatic thing that we just all have. We have to train ourselves to do that. And then we shame ourselves because I can't just do it and everyone else seems to be able to do it, Whether they're actually doing it or not is another story. Some people maybe have a natural instinct, like they may have natural talents towards doing it, and some people are masking pretty well, and some people are using other defense mechanisms to cope with the situation. I mean, you never know what's going on in a world of another, right? But that's just kind of, so we really need to, like, it's a long-term practice. It's a long-term process. It's a lifelong journey of growing up. It's a lifelong journey of learning how to parent ourselves and hold space for our inner children, or inner animals, whatever you want to call it. You know, it's the instinctive drive, really. That's what it is, and that's why it's called a child or an animal, because they're both instinctively driven. It's not a name calling or a judgment tool. It's just really just describing the mechanism behind it, and then, you know, becoming the driver in our car, becoming the one who is guiding the energy and dancing with the energy like a martial artist. You know, how am I going to maneuver this energy rather than trying to stop it or block it, but just how am I going to dance with it? What am I going to do with it?
I love that.
And then, yeah.
Yeah, no, I love that. You want to be the driver instead of having being driven. You know, you want to be the one in control, making your own decisions based on your own authentic value system, who you are, not based on like, oh my God, you know, fear driven, you know, defensiveness driven. Yeah, it's for sure. And we have time for one last question, and I would love to end just by asking you if you have, I mean, you shared so much with us, but do you have like any other little nuggets of wisdom that we haven't talked about yet that would really help people to heal from their pain and begin living a life of joy, connection, health, and well-being?
Such a great question. If there was one answer I could just say it and wrap it all up beautifully, it would be so great. But I think, again, I would just go back to just first be very, very compassionate and patient with yourself, and give yourself the permission to learn about your nervous system and learn how to regulate it. There are so many different ways of regulating the nervous system out there. Everyone finds different things that they find useful to them. But I would continue pursuing this until you figure out what works for you. To start learning, I think one of the most helpful things is to really learn what the symptoms of different nervous system states look like and feel like, the physical symptoms, the mental symptoms, the way that they show up in your body, and really start becoming aware of what nervous system state am I in at any given time. Self-awareness is like half of the solution. Right, as soon as we become aware of something, it's already shifted on some level. So no, for example, some people, like I said before, some people can live in a sympathetic nervous system state their whole life and just not be aware of it. And if you learn what the sympathetic nervous system symptoms are, then you can start noticing, like, hold on a second, I actually barely breathe, and my shoulders are always tight, and I'm like clenching my jaw all the time. Oh my goodness, that's so interesting. I didn't even realize I was so stressed. You know, and or you know, let's say I've got like a judgment voice in the back of my head that's constantly like judging people around me and assessing whether, you know, if I feel safe around them or not safe around them, and I can become aware of like, wow, that voice is really loud. How loud is it? How strong is it? What are the things that make it louder or quieter? Literally, the more awareness we can have to just observe ourselves, again, it brings us into higher consciousness when we can observe ourselves. And also, once we observe ourselves, we have material to work with. We also, that's listening. You know, in any conversation, there's listening and there's talking back.
Right.
And if we want to have a conversation with our bodies, and we want to have a conversation with ourselves to align ourselves with our value system, we have to listen, and then we can talk. So listening is self-awareness. Literally just becoming aware of what's happening. My body's talking to me through the clenching of my muscles. It's talking to me through that sensation that my digestive system is shut down, that pain in my back. It's talking to me. It's talking to me through my breath. It's talking to me through the texture of my thoughts. And the type of thinking I'm doing, and the type of patterns and the defensiveness that I'm experiencing in my consciousness. So noticing, wow, there's a part of me that's afraid, getting curious, what am I actually afraid of and why? And is it true? You know, then we can start to like engage with asking another question back. I notice you're afraid. What are you afraid of? And this is how we start talking back. We talk back by the regulation techniques, by, let's say, I notice my body's really tense. I might want to go for a run to release all of that adrenaline and cortisol that's pumping through my blood. I might want to take, you know, a cold shower. I might want to turn on some music and dance. Or have an honest conversation with God, like literally saying exactly what I'm feeling when I'm feeling it. Honesty is so powerful for regulation, like just acknowledging the reality without a judgment on it. Just, this is what it is, you know. And
Beautiful.
there's so many more ways of continuing that conversation, but that's the beginning. The beginning is developing the self-awareness, and then learning the language on how to communicate back. And
Beautiful.
the more awareness we have, the more choice we have, and the more we can live authentically. So yeah.
100%. And I love that you said that we have to have compassion for ourselves. You know, we observe how we're feeling, and then just to have compassion for ourselves without the judgment. I think that's a really, really key point, without the judgment.
Well, if I'm observing myself with judgment, it is not there's not the observational part of me that's looking at me. It is another defender. It's like I've got two voices, like two little children arguing with each other. But one child has been parentified or has taken on the role of being the wise adult inside of me. But it's not actually coming from a prefrontal cortex perspective. It's actually just another emotional react, a fear-based emotion that is disguised in irrational like judgment on me. And so often people think that they are observed becoming self-aware and they're observing themselves, but if it's coming with a judgment, it's actually fear that's they're watching themselves with, not curiosity.
Thank you for that distinction. I appreciate that. That was important. Thank you. And thank you so much, Devori, for joining us on America's Top Robinsons. In the merit of this class, may Hashem watch over all the Jewish people and give enormous strength to the IDF soldiers, including Menachem Mendel ben Rachel, Menachem Ziv HaCohen ben Rivka Malka, Menashe ben Dikla, and Mendel Tuvia ben Devorah. Thank you so much again.